Thank you. Thank you. I sometimes wish I was Victoria Wood doing that. You know, she used to charge in front of everybody and begin. I'm on my soapbox today, so I'm not going to apologise if I become rather aerated and in your face. Borrowing from the future. The challenge that underlies what I want to be saying is not just how we do justice here now, today, but how we take account of the need for justice into the future. And I speak as a baby boomer, circa 1953. And having been born in that particular year, there are certain features of my life which I can own to and suggest that other people looking in might consider to be somewhat problematic, if not troublesome. Have we got any Londoners with a freedom pass? There's some bold people admitting it. Well done. Because the freedom pass in London, which gives you free access to public transport for throughout the whole of Greater London, is one of the most prized possessions that anybody can have. And of course, those who have achieved that freedom pass are very much the lucky ones, because those of us who are coming up behind are waiting for Boris or his successor to say, oh, you'll have to be 70 now before you can have a freedom pass. And if you're a good decade or two beyond me, then younger than me, then you'll be thinking, oh, maybe you have to be 80 and with a Zimmer before you get a freedom pass. But I just want you to imagine that scene as an older professional worker sporting the freedom pass can tap it on the little Oyster disc and get free travel. And compare it to a young girl of 19, just above the minimum wage, paying full whack for London transport. There's a kind of in-your-face unfairness. And of course, it's the younger generation which is having to manage that welling up of resentment. So it never kind of surprises me, really, that younger people are a little bit slow at giving up their seats for older people, because after all, the younger people have tended to pay for it. Anybody who was born in 1948 will be well practiced in the art of free travel. 1948 has been singled out as the most fortunate year in which to have ever been born. If you were born in 1948, you will have been born into established free healthcare, free education, not to mention free love, the scope for retirement, relatively free of financial worries that started to plague younger generations, and the chances are that having been nourished from cradle to grave welfare state, those born in 1948 might just be planning the next safari or cruise. Just a little quote, and I can't actually recall whose it's from. It's not mine, but it's a good one. 1948ers would appear to have had it all. The magic was that whenever us 48ers got to a certain age, the world delivered just what we were looking for. We wanted sex. Suddenly there was the pill. We wanted to rebel, take lots of drugs and do the things our parents never did. Blow me down, along came flower power. It's as if we had ordered things from a celestial menu. No, we didn't even have to order them. They were delivered to our door. does feel that this caricature of those born in 1948 or 1953 kind of risks a reworking of that well-known parable. The prodigal son has morphed into prodigal mum and dad. Some of us here, I can see, will be part of the generation that Harold Macmillan referred to as that generation, or at least that context, where people had never had it so good. And I have to own that the story that runs through my life is of ever-increasing support and benefit and encouragement and increasing financial affluence. And for those four decades, I think we have had that assumption that such advance, such progress, would flow seamlessly into the future. We sit here very much aware that that confidence is in fact a fantasy. In fact, it's not just a fantasy. I think the issue of generational relationships is what could be described as a perfect storm. A perfect storm is worse than a worst-case scenario. A worst-case scenario is something that we hypothesize might happen. A perfect storm is something that we can see on the horizon. Something where we can actually sense coming towards us. So it's not hypothetical. It's coming and facing us, and we are going to have to negotiate how to handle it. So this issue, this concern from certainly my generation's position of plenty, with a concern for current younger and future younger generations, we can clearly recognise it as a close cousin of environmental concerns, but it is far more particular, far more intimate, far more an issue of what you and I actually do in our next decade, both for younger people and for older people. The disadvantaging of a younger generation, the disadvantaging of a younger generation is quite a rare historical occurrence. Mostly throughout history, the assumption is that things, barring plague, barring warfare, that things would be better for the upcoming generations than the older generations, even if just a tad. So we are in the midst in this perfect storm of this rarity in the history of humankind. As I say, the usual flow of advantage is future directed. A reliable expectation that the upcoming generations would have an easier, if only marginally easier, life. But of course, what we've got are books on the bookshelves with titles like The Jilted Generation, legitimizing the cry from younger generations that it's not fair. I always think it's a bit like that parable, the workers in the vineyard. It's an issue that, of course, Jesus tells the story where those who arrived and did the least work got paid as much as those who'd laboured all day. This issue of fairness is a really fraught one, and so often we find that we don't like generosity or advantage when it accumulates to anybody but ourselves. But I don't want to be saying that younger generations making the cry, "It ain't fair," is illegitimate. Because on first scrutiny, it is clearly legitimate, but it isn't an answer. So let me explain why it is that we have reached such a tricky, perfect storm situation. The first issue, is the sudden, in historical terms, increased longevity. But that is combined with the sudden and sustained fall in the birth rate. Two things. We're living a long time, but we have also had an extraordinary and sustained fall in our birth rate. I'll give you some figures at risk of boring you, but it is kind of terribly significant, particularly if we are policymakers, and that both in the church and in the wider world. In Britain, over the next 30 years, our population will age, but it will be mainly because of the lack of youngsters. The average age of our British population has risen almost twice as much because of there being fewer people than there being more elderly people. So this fewer younger people, this chosen infertility, is the issue that rarely gets acknowledged and rarely scrutinised. But all the time we are scrutinising the kind of blossoming of older people numerically. So we've got those two demographic changes, but this very surprising and previously unknown sustained low birth rate. But the other feature, and this is the one that has kind of crept up upon us, is that demographers recognise a thing called a demographic window of opportunity. And I believe that the description that Matt Millen gave, that you have never had it so good, was a description precisely to time with the demographic window of opportunity in the United Kingdom. But that we have mistaken that window of opportunity for normality. And we are busy trying to rail back those expectations of ever-increasing growth. Let me give you a definition of a demographic window of opportunity, which results in this demographic dividend. It is when the proportion of children and young people under 15 years falls below 30% of the population. And the proportion of people over 65 years and older is below 15%. And that this demographic bonus is estimated to be able to last for as long as 40 years, as long as the economy can provide employment for that middle age group. And of course, that was the British story. And demographers can look at nations around the world and actually predict when this demographic window of opportunity opens and closes. Ireland has been in a demographic window of opportunity. China, likewise, but of course a manufactured, a policy-driven window of opportunity because of the one-child policy. And how that unscrambles itself is worth a whole session at Greenbelt. So we've had an economic flourishing, but it's to do with the shape of our population. It's kind of been that sort of shape. And it's now become the cigar, or sometimes an inverted pyramid. Demography matters because demography, our population and its age structure, will always trump democracy. The trust that we have put in democracy is actually fraudulent. Assuming that people vote on the basis of self-interest, then the shape and the age profile of the population will actually scupper any efforts to distribute justice evenly. So what we have discovered in this perfect storm is that the very heart of our demographic process is destined to benefit the older at the expense of the younger. Some American commentators refer to it simply as fiscal child abuse. And of course, we've got such evidence in Britain. Over the last 15 years, there has been significant inroads made into the extent of poverty in Britain, but it is age-related. From 1994 to 2007, the number of over 65s living on low income fell from 28% to 18%, a 10% reduction in the number of older people living in poverty. Great. However, the proportion of children living in poverty during that same period fell only from 33% down to 31%, a 2% fall compared to a 10% fall. And then just to give another perspective, a subtly different perspective on that, the proportion of working parents who'd got dependent children who were living in poverty in that same period began at 26% and 13 years later remained at 26%. No change. There will be myriad factors that play a part in that resistance, but one of them will be the political difficulty of the numerically smaller, demographically smaller proportions of our population being able to be heard on the political stage. And then I'll just say this because we are all so aware of it, particularly at this time. The most deplorable thing about the government, this is a quote, continuing to land students with more and more debt is that they got their education free. I did. They'll do fine for pensions. Not sure about that one. They will have little debt and made a fortune in property by buying it when they were our age. What will our generation get? That's the youngsters. 10 years of paying off debts, a laughable pension that will be worth less than we pay in, and the prospect of paying extortionate rents to the very generation that looked out. We are the jilted generation. And one day we'll realise it all and do something about it. It's that little threat in the tale. And that, I think, is one of the reasons why it is a perfect storm. It is not just that we are confronted by structural injustice. The experience of that injustice continually gets magnified and shifts into resentment. And resentment between the generations is perhaps the most tricky and problematic form of resentment and directed resentment that we can identify. So let me add to our great perfect storm is, of course, the shock of the financial need to refund banks and the ensuing debt burden, and now the long-term turbulence of the finance markets. And of course, that adds insult to the injury, because we baby boomers yet to claim our pensions might find that they are very puny pensions indeed. So how do we even protest? How do we even protest when I have had all the benefits of you have never had it so good, and now I have not the generous pension I had anticipated, but in comparison with younger generations, would obviously appear to be exceedingly better blessed by social policy. So it even becomes difficult to know how to protest. Do I protest on the basis of my own interests? Or do I forego that and just accept the fact that, well, the dice has been rolled and the pension that comes is not like I was going to anticipate? If you think I'm exaggerating, let me just give you a quote from Philip Brown, who's a pension specialist. Do listen to this because it's ex-certificate stuff. Put simply, our figures show that most average men and women retiring in the UK today, that's the younger baby boomers like myself, that we can look forward to a state pension of under £6,000 a year, plus a private pension of £2,000. Today, the average wage for men and women is hovering around £26,000. In other words, even the baby boomers are going to be obliged to live on roughly a 70% reduction of income when we stop work. So it ain't going to be comfortable for anybody, but let us also announce that it is clearly, palpably uncomfortable for those who are younger again. What we are faced with is a cultural watershed regarding our negotiating our implicit understanding of our rights and our obligations between ages and generations. David Willetts puts it very nicely. The challenge is how to represent our vertical obligations to future generations in addition to the horizontal obligations. Horizontal obligations which are often the focus of festivals like Greenbelt, but very rarely, other than in the environmental issue, do we also take account of these vertical obligations into the future. We need to be much better at weighing the claims of the nows versus the laters. And as I've said, the chances are that we will not be able to harness the will of politicians in relation to this, because any politician who threatens to eat into the benefits of the more numerically older group has very little chance of being elected. So it is a very grim and kind of stuck situation. One of the responses that we have had to this situation is in relation to the increasing of the age of retirement. And it is a legitimate question to suggest, to ask, why is it that with all the increases in life expectancy over the last 100 years, those increases in our longevity have been assumed to be our inactive time of our life? In other words, why is it that we've never increased the retirement age previously? Well, retirement suits everyone. It is one of the great collusive aspects of our social lives. Retirement has lots and lots of advantages. Obviously, it's the removal of the workaday pressures from one's shoulders and gives scope to enjoy a kind of a life that you can choose your own priorities. But also, upcoming generations, the younger workers, can anticipate with some accuracy the likelihood, the scope for promotion into the jobs that are vacated by their retiring seniors. There is also the possibility of a more compliant workforce. It makes management easier, because those who are anticipating stepping into the shoes of their older colleagues are more likely to keep their heads down and to line up with the company principles and practices. Business likes retirement because it gets rid of the highest paid, because mostly those who are oldest have had the most increments and they are the most heavy on the wage bill. And there's a chance of moving that out and bringing those who cost less to employ through the system. And then the other feature is that with the requirement of a large pension pot to cover our great long years of inactivity in the employment market, businesses, commerce, likes the benefit from the investments that come from the pension funds. So the finance sector is energized and sustained by the movement of funds that come from this international pension fund capitalism. Retirement suits us all. And I want to suggest that the political attempt to address this perfect storm by increasing the pension age is actually the least imaginative and the most problematic. What happens is that younger people will find it even more difficult to enter into work and will find it difficult not just to get a job, but to get a job that gives a narrative of identity. So the increase in the retirement age is likely to fuel the alienation of younger generations and create an even more fractious relationship between the generations. Increasing the age of retirement is the least imaginative way through the problem of intergenerational fairness, because it increases the likelihood of the older generation staying on the top rungs of the ladder and receiving top dollar remuneration for even longer. And let's be frank, if we were to resolve the pension crisis, it would not involve us working for a further 2 years. It would actually require us to be working for a further 10 or 15 years. So even this tokenistic policy change does very little of a positive nature, but I suggest quite a significant issue in relation to the scope for younger generations to start to have work that enables younger people to shape rather than to just kind of pass time in a work. All this unfairness, and it's unfairness that is deeply structural, contributes to the potential for resentment. And once resentment gets hold, it is very hard to dampen down. It is the most unruly and uncivil of developments. And resentment of an older generation carries a particular jeopardy, because each of us, over time, we'll find ourselves aging, because becoming old, could we believe it, is everyone's hope, and we certainly prefer it to the alternative. The issue of resentment of older people is basically, it's the resentment of our future selves. That's one of the extraordinary features of aging. It is everyone's anticipated story. And so to foster resentment of that phenomenon that we are all anticipating to become really does create a psychic disturbance. When we are young or in our prime, we do not think of ourselves as already being the dwelling place of our own future old age. And that's the unique trait of this perfect storm. It is everybody's destiny to become old. And that makes resentment of older generations a very risky and psychologically costly business. The issue, of course, is that we are asking those who are most disadvantaged, those who are youngest, to do the most work in holding off the inclination to resent. So if I'm making any moral case at this point, it's unfairly carried by those who are already unfairly carrying a disadvantage into the future. So what I'm working towards is, what is it that I, as a baby boomer, need to be putting into the pot in order to try and rebalance that unfairness? But let's not kind of rush to that, but that's the journey I'm wanting to make in this session. One of the things that we have to ensure we do not fall into is the danger of blaming. And of course, I would say that, wouldn't I? Because here I am with the limelight on saying, blame me, I'm a baby boomer. That's why my previous session on this stage was about the problem of faulty thinking, which thinks to point the finger of blame is to both solve something or to give a kind of scientific answer along the cause and effect line. But let me just try out some of the things that we might want to blame for this perfect storm. We could blame medical care for prolonging life at all costs. We could blame the Germans for starting the war and causing people to hold off having children and thus bringing this bulge of baby boomers. We could blame the baby boomers for developing a selfish set of values and keeping the best for ourselves. We could blame capitalism for shaping our tastes and wrecking the planet and forgetting, of course, that capitalism and the markets on which capitalism does its business implicate all of us here. And of course, we could then start to blame women. Women for going out to work, not having children, ending marriages in divorce, and causing the price of houses to rise. But then, of course, we women could retaliate and blame men for being thoughtless husbands and responsible for all the wars and the crimes in the world. Sorry, I didn't mean to say that with such... We cannot resort to that kind of thinking in relation to this subject, because any finger pointing will just result in a bizarre analysis. This is a story about dastardliness. This is a story about each of our wills to power. This is a story of our own self-interest. That's why it's a story that I believe asks for a faith analysis. So if blaming wins the day, it might well result in action, but it's not action that's going to fix this perfect storm. It's going to add to it. As Christians, we talk about sin rather a lot, in all kinds of forms: original sin, structural sin, individual sin. I've now vowed never to talk about sin because I want to replace it with a five-syllable word, the word dastardliness. Dastardliness implies a kind of mean, tricky, sneaky behaviour that I believe often has its roots in our anxiety, but it will always be self-serving. When we get caught up in the issue of blaming, when we get caught up in the issues of casting our vote in the political system, the chances are that dastardliness and self-interest starts to come to the fore. I just want to mention very briefly the role of the media in relation to this issue and the fostering of resentment and dastardliness. Because the media can scarcely resist allowing the protagonists in relation to this issue to go full pelt. If you are somebody who's director of programs, you love this issue because it means you're going to get young and old. And that, of course, is the television programmer's delight, to get a multi-aged watching public, reading public, listening public. And so we find that the media have a particular interest in setting us against each other, of pointing the finger, of blaming one generation for all that seems to be uncomfortable for others. So for comment writers, for producers, this issue of international fairness is kind of irresistible, because anecdote and tart remark, it just jumps off the page or jumps into the media in a way that, well, writers have been longing for. The issue, of course, is that we all need each other. In particular, youngsters need their grannies. huge amounts of research, both biological, anthropological, psychological, and sociological, emphasize the significance of the generations working together. We are probably the first era in history where we have failed to give value to intergenerational relationships. The issue I believe that we face, in order not to squander the extraordinarily gifted relationship between the generations, particularly across one generation to another, which is actually programmed into our evolutionary capacity. And there are only two species where the female lives beyond menopause, where she lives beyond her capacity to reproduce. And that's in Homo sapiens and the large sea mammals. There has to be a reason for such an investment in what is apparently an unproductive state of no longer being fertile as a female. And that is because it is the role of the older, unencumbered female to nurture the next but one generation into a social world which is so complex that it cannot be sanely and safely mediated by the parenting generation. And having been somewhat tetchy in relation to men, let me add the role of older men as peacemakers and to model the capacity to effect change without going to war is probably one of the most precious offerings that our society could long for. To bring it down to very earthy situations, if you want to predict what's the best chance of a youngster getting free of crack cocaine, it's the extent to which his or her grandmother is involved in their lives. That's the kind of work that goes on between the generations. Erikson refers to it as grand generativity. That's the generativity beyond middle age. In middle age, we're responsible for maintaining and perpetuating our own household. But grand generativity is about care of the present combined with concern for the future, especially for future generations, and for generations not yet born, and for the survival of the world as a whole. Let me read to you from him. Grand generativity contributes to the sense of immortality that becomes so important in the individual struggle to transcend the realistic despair of getting older. Grand generativity's concern for the future in the abstract must be integrated into the simple, direct caring for specific individuals who are part of life today. So my message is to those of us who are baby boomers and older. It is, how do we face up to this calling, this healthy state of grand generativity? Why is it that we haven't been challenged to this before? And I want to offer some of the ways in which being a pivot generation, a generation of baby boomers who will actually alter the way in which we live and the direction of our efforts, what would that look like if we were to become such a pivot generation? And I think it's important that it's on par with all the work that went on with Jubilee 2000, that we actually need to become a movement. We actually have to say that there are enough of us to counter that demographic power of older people that means that politicians will always be mealy-mouthed in relation to this fairness between the generations. So I'd like to see Greenbelt and those baby boom Greenbelters to learn from Jubilee 2000 and practice and learn from each other about how it is we become a pivotal movement, to give politicians the confidence that there are sufficient numbers of us who are willing to vote using compassionate criteria rather than just voting on the basis of self-interest. That we as a pivot generation, probably the generation that has discovered and rejoiced in that kind of narcissism, that kind of self-love that has now gone on and gained ever greater momentum, that we replace that with compassionate intentionality. That we actually practice the resistance to blaming and the habit of scapegoating. That we demonstrate that to our grandchildren and to those whom we are invited to help shape. That we as a baby boom generation become astute politically, because it is terribly hard to work out what the balance of advantages between the generations in relation to our complex social policy. It is really tricky to know whether some of the family policies are actually helping or hindering upcoming generations. That we have to welcome the fact that, and rejoice in the fact of paying tax, and there are enough tents around this place which encourage us in that way. Let's join the Fair Pensions movement, which is about saying that our colossal pension savings need to put pressure onto the big companies to pay living wages and to pay tax. That's our money. Actually, it's a very interesting phenomenon about pensions and the way they've shaped up, but that might come out in a question. That those of us who are baby boomers, that we must not moan about inheritance tax. That we must actually listen to people like Julian Legrand, who says, forget inheritance tax, because all that will do is to make those who are already rich looking after their offspring who are already likely to be rich. But what we need is a windfall tax. A windfall tax is something that is paid by those who receive money from the deceased's estate. But the more people whom you include in your will, the more you spread it about, then actually less tax gets paid by those people who are recipients. So there are ways in which our tax system can be reshaped in order that money doesn't stay in a lump that's been accumulated by the lucky post-war generation. The Robin Hood tax movement, that starts to become a priority for baby boomers. And then the issue of working for free. Why is it that we assume that we have to be paid to work? It's very clear from the work of positive psychology that if we want to have a good experience of old age, then we work from our what are called signature strengths, our distinctive personal capacities. And the chances are few of us have been employed to deliver from our signature strengths. There's something that we've had to find a route, an informal route, to deliver on. We need to be doing that as a pivot generation. And of course, if we work for free, we can then create business plans which are quite different from those that dominate in the world of the market. Because our signature strengths are contributions that are so precious they defy being able to be costed. And then I finish with the idea of, now listen well here, supra-sex. I shall spell it so as you don't get confused. S-U-P-R-A-S-E-X. And it has a kind of more mundane title. It's called vocational arousal. It's the pleasure involved in cooperative creativity, exciting in each other the desire and capacity to create something new. So my final shot and suggestion is that for those of us who are baby boomers, for whom everything has come our way before we've even thought to ask, that maybe we ought to start rejoicing in that capacity for supra-sex in order to allow the market-restricted business of employment to those who are younger. I would be grateful for more suggestions to add to that list of ways in which we can pivot as baby boomers. There must be many more. Thank you.
So who has a question?
Hello, thanks. That's a very interesting talk, but I was wondering if I could challenge your most fundamental assumption. You claimed that the best year to be born was 1948.
Yes.
I was born in 1988, and if you gave me the option of being born 40 years earlier, the answer would be very definitely no.
Right.
And a lot of what you're describing as being negative features seem to actually be the flip side of positive ones. Higher pension costs, flip side of living longer, tuition fees, flip side of significantly larger number of people going to university, and climate change even, flip side of significantly higher prosperity. I mean, do we actually even need to be worrying about this? It seems to me my generation's actually quite a lot luckier than yours is in many regards.
Right, right. I'd be interested to see whether others feel that. It's always a very difficult thing to talk about generations. Because there will be generations, people born in 1948, for whom life has been nasty, mean, brutish and short. I think the emphasis is about the opening up of possibility. Now, my hunch is to live a life where there is this sense of things opening up is of itself a great boon. To be living through a time where you have to negotiate gridlocks and malfunctions is quite a psychologically challenging environment. So I'm only suggesting that in terms of, if you want, opportunity being perceived, perhaps naively, and gridlocks and malfunctions coming on the horizon. I certainly wouldn't want to go to town to say it is just the commentariat. We'll say 1948, it all opens up. But I would like to know whether people would go in that same direction. I'd rather be born in 1988 or 1948. Don't know quite how we...
So I really appreciate your comments about grand generativity and the role that that might play, to kind of switch gears a little bit. I'm curious about comparative, because one of the things that the Russian Orthodox Church will talk about is that the Russian Orthodox Church was able to survive the Bolshevik persecutions because of the faith of grandmothers, and how the grandmothers were very active in imparting a spirituality in that country. And so I'm curious about what seeds of true growth, true joy, true livelihoods are current in the generation of grandmothers and grandfathers, or are you guys also trying to redefine well-being for yourselves, having always been receiving the welfare state?
Well, first of all, you use the kind of the conceptual filler, you guys, and I understand that, because one of the reasons of why it's so difficult to manage this perfect storm is, of course, the you guys is not a valid, there's no such thing as generation baby boom. It's just a kind of label that gets used. But one of the things that is around for us is that the view of growing older is increasingly dominated by the idea that the aim is to extend a middle age style of life, whether it's in relation to appearance or in relation to the activities that we get involved in. If we are to embrace, those of us who are of a certain age, to embrace the additional potential of life that Erickson refers to as grand generativity, then we have to strip off that urge for old age to be just an extension of middle age, and embrace activities and values which I think are not valued strongly in our society. So I think that would be why I don't anticipate the generation of which I might be representative of as being very as good as those resilient grannies of a Russian context, because of this false assumption that our challenge is to continue being middle-aged and elegant and fit and a bit like absolutely fabulous.
Hi, I'm a young person, also 1998, and I've had two people of the baby boom generation essentially say to me, we've screwed up, really sorry, it's your responsibility. And I think that one of the main things that I find frustrating is that maybe as you get older, you feel like you've done your bit. And I think you haven't done your bit. You've still got us.
I think so.
We're young and inexperienced. That's all I'd say.
And of course, that's the issue, that our longevity, and it may just be that there's only a couple of generations that will experience this extraordinary longevity. But if you're a middle-class woman, the chances are that we will go on to about the age of 94, and only 4 years of that will be about any kind of physical or mental diminishment, the kind of relinquishing stage of life, which averages about 4 years, which means that our capacity for being active stretches up to about the age of 86. And that's the need for some kind of plumbing, so as that older generation, which we all aspire to become, can actually deliver responsibly, is not yet forged. And that, I think, is why we need this conversation, in order that we can act responsibly, rather than just go on cruises.
Thank you. I found it a very helpful, interesting talk. It's really useful to see this debate opened up here. One of the issues you talk about is carrying on middle age and not going into the grand generativity. Where I see this most apparent is in the housing inequality, and many single or couples living in large houses while there's so many young people cannot afford to even start a family or start a home. I'd be interested to hear your comments.
This issue about housing is often the pulse beat which drags us into an even worse perfect storm. Because what's happening is that people are having to put off child rearing. And I also suspect that the need for two incomes to sustain housing is such that the experience of being a parent is likely to be anticipated as being overburdensome. So we've moved to a situation where the most natural inclination and potential delight, the real creativity, the real generativity, has suddenly become too personally costly. And that, I think, is for me when I think we have to press the panic buttons. But how we respond. And the other issue, of course, why this is such a tricky issue, is that the analysis is so enticing. But the analysis doesn't really get us into a place where we can provide imaginative steps to help address it. And that's why somewhere like Greenbelt is so good, because Greenbelters have a good nose for what's analysis and what's actually praxis. Where's the action coming from? And how we gain momentum and encouragement to deliver it. But I think housing, particularly in the south of the country, is just giving momentum to a place the species never been to. No species has ever forgone fertility. And we are doing it with great kind of confidence, really.
Hello. I appreciate all that you've said, and I think it's very relevant to society today and to the gap between the older and the younger generations. And I'm one of those lucky ones. I have a bus pass and I value it. But actually, if I were really honest, I probably don't actually need it. I've heard a lot this week about poverty.
About
poverty, and there are many older people, many retired people, who are in genuine poverty, and if their bus passes, God forbid, were removed, they would not have the ability, they would not have the financial ability to go down the road, get on a bus, travel into town to the shops, and certainly could not afford to run a car. Not only that, they don't have the privilege of a reduced private pension. Yeah. They don't have any private pension. And they are in a situation where they see actually the cost of living rising, fuel, in particular, the cost of fuel in particular going up.
Okay, can I come back on that one? Because I think your comments illustrate just what a tricky issue this is. Because as you were talking, my first response, I thought, oh, I'm going to challenge you. I'm going to say that the evidence is that there are fewer and fewer poor older people. But actually, that would be for me to fall into the kind of tit-for-tat way of dealing with this issue. This issue of intergenerational fairness challenges both our thinking style, our emotional reactions, and the language we use. So if we find that older people can only speak on behalf of older people, then we've already gone 50% down the route of promoting resentment. We know, and this is why we're working with generalizations, that there will always be exceptions to that. So this issue is a real intellectually challenging issue, and it challenges both at the level of our capacity to conceptualize, but also our level, our way in which we actually describe the phenomenon. And I'm looking for older people to defend the case and to promote the case of youngsters, as grand generativity would encourage us to do. And I'm looking for younger people to say, yeah, and we mustn't forget there are some poor old people. That would be a step. Sorry, I don't, you know, we're just using it as an illustration. Don't want to knock you down on that.
Thank you for your talk. That was very interesting. You said that it's a good time to be born if you're a baby boomer, and on the surface it is. But in a way, it was once thought that smoking wasn't particularly harmful for you, and it was quite a nice, sociable thing to do, and it's become hard to admit that it's not good for us. Would it help us to remain sort of together as a community, old and young, living peacefully, if we could all start to admit that the last 40 years haven't been good for the future generations, and actually economic growth at any cost is not a good thing and not a good goal? Particularly obvious in the house prices, which benefited the baby boomers and not the younger generations. And I think that it would be easier for the younger people to avoid resentment and easier for the older people to feel compassionate if we could say, actually, it hasn't all been a good thing the last 40 years. It wasn't a good thing to have happened.
Repentance would do no harm at all. But as we know, repentance has to be accompanied by a real about turn. Hence the term pivot. So there's, I think we need to imagine the actions that would give authenticity to such a repentance. But clearly, you know, we've been caught up as generations, both academically and commercially, in assuming that boom is normality. And that's been partly why we're talking perfect storm, because there's a generation that's coming through which is having to negotiate this discovery that economic growth is time limited, and that we'd assumed that progress could just be safely rolled out into the future. That's a big error, and we only start to understand it when we experience the reality of what's happening. Over there, where has he gone?
Just over here, sorry.
Oh, sorry.
Thank you very much, and this is less a question and more sort of a couple of observations, really. There's sort of a generation that recognises the need to sort of give something back, if you like, is very commended and good to hear. But I think, actually, you know, whatever generation you're in, I think that the fundamental issue is each generation almost tries to spend more than it ever earns, and actually there's a lifestyle sort of economic across the course of everyone's life. I mean, I'm just sort of looking at my age now, and you sort of think, well, if you're in education until 25, work till, I mean, okay, it was 65, a little bit longer, and then live till 90. Fundamentally, if you're working for 40 years and living 50 years without working, you'll have to put more than half your salary away in pension provision just for that to make sense. And I think my parents now, when they die, will probably be the first generation that don't have to give to help me buy a house, but ultimately will end up giving down a double generation to fund education, for example. But there is actually a cycle about it, and as long as each generation lives within their own means across their whole lifespan, then it needs to make sense.
Maybe.
Unfortunately, that is all the time we've got. So thank you once again to Morrissey.
Thank you very much. Yep.